diets can make a big difference in your pet's quality of life. Hi, this is Jill Najoe. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is back with us. She is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be talking about those special diets, and we'll also discuss the MDR1 gene and what it can mean to your dog if he has it. We'll also be answering your pet questions, so give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hello, Sandy.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Therapeutic diet.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a perception, at least through what I see on Dr. Google, that a lot of pet owners feel that veterinarians are in the rear pocket of the pet food companies, you know, and they we make recommendations of certain diets because of that. And we are doing it for a totally different reason. These therapeutic diets that are out there that are considered prescription-type diets, where they can only be given by a veterinarian, they can't be sold over-the-counter, are there to help a whole host of problems. And, you know, in many shows, I've talked about putting pets on hydrolyzed protein diets to rule out food allergies. And that's just one thing. There are just a host of diseases that can be managed and provide the pet with a longer life and a better quality of life by using some of these diets. And I'll give an example of an animal that's got kidney disease. When we have an animal with failing kidneys, the kidneys are responsible for getting rid of protein waste products. And so by having extra protein in the diet, that's going to put more stress on the kidneys because it has to get rid of all these protein waste products that are part of the natural way of protein digestion. The waste product that people know of is called urea. And when your veterinarian checks your dog or cat's blood and says the BUN is up, that stands for blood urea nitrogen, that's telling us, it's one of the clues that your animal may have kidney disease. So these kidney-friendly diets tend to have lower protein in them, which makes it easier for the kidneys to work. And that's one of the reasons why they have to be a prescription-type diet, because a growing dog, a pregnant dog, is not going to do well on these diets. And so they are different than over-the-counter diets and need to be used under veterinarian supervision. And that's not all that is special about kidney diets. They tend to be higher in potassium, since a lot of animals have issues with their potassium, which can affect their strength and their muscles and their GI system. They tend to be lower in phosphorus, one of those minerals that the kidneys, when they're not working well, has a hard time getting rid of. So there's a number of reasons why we have animals on these diets. And so when your vet makes that recommendation, take it seriously. Seriously, and realize that there are lots of companies out there, and you can even get these diets home delivered now. Oh. Some of these, it still requires a prescription, but just today I came back in and there was a couple of faxed prescriptions from some of these online pet food services. And I have absolutely no problem with owners ordering it, because we make virtually no profit from these diets. They are expensive. And I want to see a pet on it in any way an owner can save money and make it easy for them. By all means, do that. And don't think that if your pet doesn't eat one diet, that it may not eat another. And so pet food manufacturers that make these diets, many of them have a money back guarantee. If your pet won't eat it, we'll take the bag back. So you're not going to be out 50, 60 bucks or whatever it is for the bag of food. But I hope that other people maybe will call in and let us know if their pets are on any of these diets and how they're doing and what they're using them for, because lots and lots of reasons why we use it.
Well, I can tell you that one of my dogs has renal problems, and she's been eating it, and it seems to have made a difference for her.
It really can make them have them live longer and be a lot happier while they're on this diet, because it takes some of the stress off of the kidneys. But we use it for things like seizure control, allergies, for derm defense type things, for mobility issues, gastrointestinal issues, bladder stones. The list goes on and on and on. And just know that we can nutritionally that's one of those things that we can do as veterinarians is help your pet have a healthier, happier life with maybe sometimes not using anything medicinal besides the diet.
Now, buying that food, there's sticker shock. So why is it so expensive, Sandy?
Because it has to be made, formulated, and there's a lot of research behind these diets. And so they have to formulate it with certain ingredients that are going to be more expensive to make sure that it has like the right mineral content or provides the right pH for the urine. And so they are more expensive. And sometimes it's just the way the ingredients have to be handled. Things like the hydrolyzed protein diet, often they're made with chicken, but chicken is not a very expensive ingredient. But because they have to break that chicken down into little protein bits that the body doesn't recognize where it came from, there is that as part of the manufacturing cost as well. And then there's also the clean out between batches. Many pet foods are, you know, they just go from one batch to the next. They may change flavor and there may be some cross-contamination, and big deal, it's not a problem if it's your pet doesn't have a health issue. But if your pet has a health issue, that's something that we really need to take seriously. So they can be expensive, which is why I'm a big advocate of, if you've got a multi-pet household, invest in some of these electronic pet bowls that only let the pet that needs to be on the diet eat the diet, so that you're not feeding the whole family. One, it may not be nutritionally sound for the younger pet or the other pet in the household, but it also is, you know, pretty expensive to be yes. feeding multiple pets a prescription diet where maybe only one pet needs it.
Very good point. Well, we do have some callers waiting online, so let's go over there right away. We've got Mona waiting for us in Madison. Hi, Mona.
Hi, thanks. I got both the UW vet school for care for his kidney, and he was just diagnosed. He's almost 16. He's a little dachshund. He's diagnosed last year, and they put him on the kidney diet. We tried the Royal Cane, and we tried the Science diet. We tried the dry. We tried the can. We tried the stew. He doesn't really, they said, you know, it's not very palatable. The dogs don't usually like it. He doesn't. And so we've been having to either add some, like, boiled chicken or some, you know, cooked hamburger, or mix it in with some other kind of dog food. And I know he's just supposed to get the KD and stuff, but he won't eat it. He's lost, like, over a pound.
You know, and part of the reason why he may not be eating is because he has kidney disease. And the kidney diets really over the years have become much more palatable. Not that I've tried it, but they've put a lot more effort into making them palatable, because dogs and cats with kidney issues are often feeling a little nauseous. So you may want to talk to the veterinarian that you're working with about, you know, should your dog be on some type of anti-nausea medication? Do they need some fluid supplementation to help lower some of those kidney toxin things that are in the blood that make them feel sick? And we always like to try these diets when the pet is still feeling, you know, really good, if we can. And it sounds like your dog was probably diagnosed and was, you know, in the throes of kidney disease. That's probably not the time to start a new diet. So usually we get them home, get them back into eating again, get them hydrated, make them feel better, and then gradually switch over to this therapeutic diet. By you adding in all the protein that you're adding in, you have just undone almost all the good of that expensive diet that you're feeding your dog. So that's one thing that we recommend, is don't add in other things. Or if you do need to add in other things, do it with the supervision of your veterinarian. Things like carbohydrates would probably be fine, like rice or potatoes, a little bit like that, to add some extra calories and not really throw off the protein or phosphorus balance. The protein that you're using would really be contraindicated for a dog with kidney disease. There are some therapeutic diet recipes, homemade type diets, or you can get them formulated through different, they actually are companies run by veterinarian nutritionists that do home food making consultation. And one of the companies is called Balance It, where you can go in and say what your dog's disease is, and they can come up with a recipe for you to follow. Obviously, you have to have the right supplements and things in there. But there are things like that available out there that may be easier for you to use if you don't mind cooking for your dog. But that's a real problem. You know, we see a lot of people doing that, and it's like,
it's difficult.
It's so difficult. Add things in.
Patience is a very good factor in that too, Mona. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to a little bit different question from Logan in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Logan. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I rescued an umbrella cockatoo about 4 weeks ago, and somebody had slit his chest, about a 6-inch gash right across from it. And he's healed up nicely except for like one square inch that he continually picks at.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if there's anything dietary-wise or a particular enrichment that you may recommend. Exactly. I want to, before I put a collar on him, which I feel like can be more stressful than maybe put one on a dog or so, to get that wound healed up.
Yeah, that's a problem. It's because we know that some birds will feather pick for behavioral reasons. And so your idea of enrichment, the correct full spectrum lights, all those things, you know, diet, you know, things to keep them entertained really may be helpful because there may be a behavioral component. But the fact that this is in the area where the bird was injured makes me think that there may be some hypersensitivity in that area. Sometimes we do have to just bite the bullet. And even though the bird looks a little funny with an e-collar on, having that on when you're not actively with your bird and keeping them entertained may allow that area to heal, the sensitivity decrease a little bit, and so that eventually the collar comes off and your bird will be fine. But look into getting one of those Elizabethan collars, the little mini ones, like, you know, the cone of shame, but they make them for birds as well.
Yeah.
You know, there are vests and things that birds can wear that may be helpful too if you want to try something like that. They're just a little harnessy type thing that may help prevent that bird from being able to get at the area. But even then, I've seen some birds rip through those and still get at themselves. So they've got pretty powerful beaks. So that e-collar may be necessary.
Okay. And kudos to you, Logan, for taking that pet
and that bird
and fixing them up. Before we go back to the phones, Julie emailed and she has a diabetic dog in the family that does not like the food the vet recommended. What should she look for when buying food? Is chicken protein best or another protein?
It's really not the protein that's an issue. When we have a dog that's diabetic, we tend to feed them very differently than we do a diabetic cat. Typically for dogs, we use a high fiber diet to kind of slow that glucose absorption. And so we get them on something that's a therapeutic diet that is a high fiber diet. And there are multiple brands that are out there that you could pick and choose which one would work. Often when I am sending an animal home with a therapeutic diet, we stock 3 or 4 brands and we'll send samples home. And even some of the companies have little sample boxes and things that you can try different things. But I would be looking at a high fiber diet and not so much the protein that you're using. And it's really important to feed a pet that's a diabetic on a schedule and know that they're eating to be able to put the food down, make sure they're eating, and then you give the insulin. Because if you give the insulin and they're not eating, that's going to really drop that blood sugar if they've got an empty tummy. So we got to find something that your dog likes. And again, you may have to be resorting to a balanced homemade diet. But there are many, many palatable diets that are out there that would be suitable for an animal with diabetes.
Okay. Thanks for that email, Julie. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And we're talking about pets. Do you have a question? Give us a call. And our number, 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Right now, we're talking about pets. And, you know, we've got a line open. So if you've been waiting, now's the time. 1-800-642-1234. Let's go right back to the phones then, Sandy. Stephanie is next, and she's in Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
What can we help you with today?
I have a 12-week-old puppy. And her litter mates, we're on a Facebook group. We rescued them together, and some of them have reported that they have hookworm. I had a fecal test done for her 2 weeks ago, and it came back clear, but one of the women mentioned that sometimes there could be a false positive for hookworm. I'm just wondering, I'm thinking about getting her retested, but I'm wondering the warning signs I should look for. She seems to be pooping solid, but sometimes, you know, there is a little bit of a diarrhea every now and then, but I feel like that's maybe normal puppy stuff. Just kind of wondering your recommendations and what I should look out for.
Yeah, hookworms are a parasite that is more common probably down south than they are in our area. And so I'm wondering if these dogs that got rescued came from a southern state. They are a parasite that if you look at them, they've got this suction cup-like mouth on them with teeth, and they attach to the intestinal tract and drink blood. And so probably the warning signs that we'll see with a heavy infestation, you may have the puppy maybe anemic, having diarrhea, maybe losing blood and have dark, tarry stool. I mean, but it can be just absolutely normal like your dog, although the intermittent diarrhea has me a little bit concerned. Puppies eat things that they shouldn't at times, and that can upset their tummy. But it still potentially could be a problem for your dog, since the other puppies all came from the same environment and they're seeing hookworms. My concern as a veterinarian is often for the people that are living with these dogs as well, because if the dog is defecating outside, especially in this hot, humid weather, and you're not right on picking up droppings, the hookworm larvae like to sit up on grass blades. And if you're walking through your yard in bare feet, it can cause a condition called cutaneous larval migrans in people. The larvae will penetrate through your skin and cause this like kind of red, itchy track. And so I always tell people, if you've had a pet with hookworms, don't go out in your backyard with bare feet or even open-toed shoes. Wear full shoes and socks. Then once we've had a good freeze and winter, that will kill off those larvae. That's why it's a problem more down south than it is up here. So I worry about your health. But this is one of the reasons why a heartworm preventatives, most of them will have something in them, or just the heartworm preventative itself will control hookworms, because this is a zoonotic disease, and it's very common. And by giving this monthly, it helps eradicate anything the dog has been exposed to. So it's possible that the reason why your dog came back negative is if you just recently gave a heartworm preventative, that may have eliminated the adults from the intestinal tract. And so the eggs that are looked at under the microscope when we do a fecal flotation aren't going to be there. But if your dog goes back out in the yard again, they can get reinfected. So keep them on that monthly heartworm preventative. I would just be very cautious with your puppy, since the other dogs in the litter have it, for your own sake, not so much for the puppy.
Okay. And what a great idea to have a Facebook group of the puppy owners.
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah,
they're
able to see how the dogs are growing and things. Yeah.
That's really great. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that question, Stephanie. Next up, we've got Karen in Glendale. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
What can we help you with?
Oh, my gosh. I've got two dogs that are eating bark, and I've had dogs for 30 years and have never had dogs eat bark and sticks. And my yard, of course, is landscaped with bark, and walking down the street, we have sticks. And I'm wondering whether or not it's a food deficiency.
I've never met a dog with a wood deficiency before. I think it's just they like to have something to chew on.
Yeah.
I have a dog that's, of my three dogs, one of them, he will bring in, we call him our kindling machine. We have a dog door, and I will often, if a branch falls off one of my trees in the backyard, I'll come home from work and he'll have this thing chewed up on my carpet in the living room and just has gone to town ripping all the bark off. He'll bring in firewood if we have a firewood stacked up for a fire outside. So it can just be the dog's own preference, and you just are lucky enough to have two of them. What I get worried about, though, is there are some mulches out there that can be very problematic for dogs. The mulch that we get most concerned about is the cocoa bean mulch, because there is enough of the active stimulant in there from the processing of cocoa beans to be toxic to the dog. And so I don't recommend using that in a yard. And plus, it smells good. If you ever open one of those up, it smells like chocolate.
Yeah.
And that can attract dogs to it. And so even if you don't have a dog that normally eats bark and you decide to use that, it could be a problem. So if you have dogs, don't use the cocoa mulch.
Exactly. I've had a couple of dogs who like to eat wood.
Yeah.
They just do. So,
and we get worried. I mean, it can cause, we've seen splinters in the roof of the mouth. It can cause GI upset. We've had wood splinters going through and causing GI obstruction. So it's something that I discourage dogs from doing if you can. Mm-hmm. But if your dog is like really consuming, not just chewing it and spitting it out, but actually eating it, sometimes we have to resort to using like a basket muzzle when they're outside. So there's a number of things like that we can use to help prevent them from getting into trouble.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Karen. Next, we've got Andrea in Watertown. Hi, Andrea.
Hello. I'm calling, number one, I just lost my wonderful cat, too.
Oh, we're so sorry.
Kidney disease. But number one, most people can't afford those expensive foods. I couldn't, and I paid a lot to my vet for the B12 shots with water, which helped a lot. But I have two cats. One cat, thank goodness, is still with me, but I didn't realize for the longest time how serious my cat was because I have two litter pans, and the other kitty, I didn't realize how serious she was because,
You know, cats are really, really good at hiding disease.
Oh, they sure are.
And that's, you know, we get them in for their annual physicals, and that's why it's so important. We do that head to toe, look at everything, and people are really surprised when we're palpating the abdomen. We go, boy, the kidneys feel a little bit small. Maybe the bladder's really big because the cat's making so much urine. But we look at things like that. And sometimes we have to just do periodic screening because even the cat that looks healthy sitting on the table can have some pretty serious disease going on. And cats are living longer than ever. And kidney disease, unfortunately, is one of those things where as they get older, because we're keeping them healthier with the balanced diets and staying indoors and the great vaccination program, and so on, we are seeing many cats develop kidney disease down the road. And it's not something that if you feed them a special diet when they're younger, you can prevent. It's one of those things that we watch for, we manage. And things that you would be watching at home would be perhaps the size of the urine balls in the litter box if you're using the scoopable litter. And that's one of the questions I ask owners is, how much urine is your cat making? Are you seeing more clumps or bigger clumps in the litter pan? And that may be enough to tell me we better check a urine sample and some blood work to see where this cat's, what's going on. Because besides kidney disease doing that, diabetes can do that. Cats that are hyperthyroid can produce more urine. So there's a number of things that we start looking for. And I know that the diets can be expensive. Things that you may want to be looking into would be if you in the future for your currently healthy cats would be, you know, like I said, some of the online food delivery services. You can get it on a, rotating. They send it to you every 6 weeks or whatever it may be. That can save you some money that way too. And then, of course, only feeding the cat that really needs the diet and feeding them a measured amount, not just having it out where they can eat willy-nilly, but the right amount of calories for the cat's needs. And you'd be surprised how inexpensive it can be if you're feeding the right quantity of this food. If you've got multiple cats eating it, obviously it's going to be very expensive, but there are ways we can get help you out that way. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the question. Next, we're going to Joyce in Mequon. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, we have two cats, they're cousins. Our male cat just turned 16, and he was diagnosed about almost 6 years ago with an enlarged heart, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and he has been on an AD mixture diet with his regular Friskies. He doesn't care much for the AD flavor. He loves his Friskies. So I mix it about half and half. And in the last few months, he has begun dropping little rocks on occasion, maybe once or twice every couple of weeks, around the house to let me know that he's constipated. Part of his, the medication that he's on a lot of meds, part of his medication regime is includes Lasix, which really dries him out. And I'm wondering if there's anything that we can give him to soften his stools a little bit to make it easier for him. So it's not that he's constipated all the time, mm-hmm. but on occasion, if he's, and he's done wonderfully, you would never know that he was as sick as he is.
Yeah, this is one of the a question I would have to probably have for your veterinarian is, why is your cat still on this diet called AD? AD is a diet that is like an acute care diet that's able to be syringed into like a stomach tube, feeding tube. It's really high in calories, and it's just to kind of get the animal over the hump if they haven't been eating, but it's not meant to be used as a long-term food. There are diets out there that are heart diets that are usually lower in salt and things to be able to help the heart. But typically, we just, for cats, feeding them just whatever at this point, if there's no other health problems for your cat, whatever he wants to eat. I would be adding water to the canned food as well. Whatever canned food he likes, I'd say add as much water as you can. Start slow, gradually add, so you're making kind of a cat food soup. That way he gets more water into him, especially with being on a diuretic like Lasix to help with his heart failure. We do sometimes add in stool softening agents for kitties that are experiencing what your cat is. And the one that I use is just over the counter is one called Miralax. That's the human tasteless powder that you can mix in with their canned food. And that will often help hold moisture in the stool and make the stool a little bit easier to pass. And so that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about. I don't think it would be contraindicated with what your cat is currently dealing with, but I'd really question why the AD. If your cat is willing to eat commercial pet food, by all means feed that. But the fact that your cat is 16, it may now have something else besides heart disease. And we will often monitor these cats that are on diuretics and check their electrolytes, check their kidney values to make sure that we're not misdiagnosing something like having a cat on Lasix or urinating more and missing the fact that they may have underlying kidney disease. And then your cat may benefit from a therapeutic diet for the kidneys.
Okay, thank you, Joyce. Appreciate that question. Next, we've got Joe in Mineral Point. Hello, Joe.
Hi. We live on a farm, and we have these barn cats. And this year, they've gotten out of control. They're semi-wild. They come up for food, but you can't catch them or hardly touch them. And we're having a population explosion, and it seems to me that you should be able to get a birth control, something that you could put in their food. I mean, humans have birth control pills, but you can't even catch these cats, and they're just they're reproducing like rabbits. And so, what can I do?
Well, I wish there was something that we could add to their food, but I don't know of anything that's available. I would be recommending that you contact your local animal shelter. Here in the Madison area, we have a group called Friends of Ferals, which is able to trap cats like this, get them spayed and neutered, and then put them back on your property again. And often, once you've got an established colony, it's not going to grow. But obviously, if you've got intact animals, the population will grow. But this is what's involved with the trap, neuter, release program. And it keeps populations kind of at a stable level. So I'd be recommending contacting them. You may have to live trap these cats and just you know, you make arrangements to when you catch them, you bring them in, the surgery gets done, and you take them home and release them again. And it's very common for local groups to be able to do this at no cost or minimal cost. So I think that would be your best bet.
Yeah, good luck, Joe. Let's go to Rosemary in Maple. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi. I have a question for the doctor. We recently lost our 12-year-old rescue dog. He was like 80 pounds and kind of like a Great Dane pit bull mix, so he was very tall. He was normally very active, and one day he just started getting really lethargic, couldn't go out, you know, down the stairs to do his business, and then he got really, like, he couldn't get up. So we took him to the vet. They took a panel. They took all kinds of tests. And they said, well, just take him home and watch him for a couple of days. Well, we waited like a day and a half. He was not eating. I made him burger, you know, hamburger meat, real tasty and everything, but he would not eat. He was drinking water. And when we took him into the office, I guess they said something about there was some kind of a tumor that had touched the spleen and part of the kidney, and it exploded or something. So, we had to put him to sleep that day.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing else to do. Now, is there anything? The only thing that they found in his blood was that he had a high protein content, but the doctor wasn't concerned about it.
Yeah, the high protein content may have just been the fact that the dog was dehydrated. Sometimes that will, when they're not taking in enough fluid because they're feeling ill, we'll see their blood get a little more concentrated, which gives us a high protein level. But I think the type of cancer that your dog probably had is one that's quite common in large breed dogs, and it's called hemangiosarcoma. It's a tumor of blood vessels, and so obviously it's very fragile, and all it takes is, you know, a little bump or something, or sometimes just the dog doing nothing, they'll rupture and the dog will bleed internally. And they may have a little bleed and have a period of weakness. The body may absorb the blood again because it hasn't spilled out of the dog's body. They're able to kind of re-auto-transfuse themselves. But if they have a big enough bleed, they become obviously very weak and aren't able to get up and are not feeling well. Because this is a tumor of blood vessels, it tends to metastasize and spread all over the body. Usually by the time we diagnose it, it's in multiple organs, often in the lungs, and there may not be a whole lot that we can do. I've had many patients where we've made the diagnosis, we've gone in and surgically removed the tumor and had them go through chemotherapy. In fact, my own dog had this type of cancer, one of my dogs many years ago. And even with chemotherapy, he lived about another 5 months comfortably, but it doesn't have a really good long-term prognosis. I'm so sorry that you lost your dog, but 12 is a pretty good age for a large breed dog, an 80-pound dog. That's right up there. And I wish we could make them live forever, but unfortunately, you know, cancer is one of those things. You live long enough, if you don't get hit by a car or die of an infectious disease, you're probably going to get cancer if you're a large breed dog.
Yeah, and so sorry. It's so difficult to deal with, Rosemary. Next up, we have Candace, who's in Madison. Hi, Candace.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My boyfriend's going to be moving in with me, and he has two cats, both 15 years old. They're sister and brother. They do have their claws. I have a 17-year-old little petite cat with no claws on the front, and she's on a special diet I've already changed the litter and her diet to the cat food that his cats are on, but mine also gets wet food because she has not very many teeth left. How do we get these cats together?
Oh, this is going to be a little bit of a trial because they're older and they're going to be less willing to adapt to the change in household arrangements. not impossible, but it's going to be some work on your part. Definitely keep them separated. You want to make sure that they have their own litter boxes, food bowls, and I would let them get used to just the fact that there are other cats in the house. So maybe your boyfriend's cats stay in the bedroom and your cat gets the run of the house, and then you can switch them around so that they get used to each other's odors before you even let them see each other. We don't want to just open the door, say, here's your new roommates, because that can create some long-standing tension between the cats. And for elderly cats like this, that's going to be really a problem, because if they go even a couple of days without drinking, if they've got some underlying health issues or not eating, then we, you know, may exacerbate problems like kidney disease and things like that. So, trying it very slowly. There are some pheromone type things that you can plug in. There's one that's called Feel Away Multicat to help multiple cats kind of get used to each other. It kind of calms them down. There are two types of these pheromone products, one that's just called Feel Away and one that's Feel Away Multicat. And I would be going with the Multicat one. So make sure you buy the right one. They're little aerosol atomizers that just plug into the wall. And that may be of some benefit as well. When it comes to feeding the cats, this is where we run into troubles. People like to have cat food down 24/7 for their cats, and not all cats can eat that way. You feed your cat a canned food. I'd be looking at some of the electronic feeders. There's one that's called the SureFeed feeder that reads the pet's microchip and only lets the cat that has that microchip be able to eat. It's got a little flap that opens up. They sell them online. You can get them through, you know, just about anywhere. They run about $120, $130. They're not cheap, but it may allow your cat to be able to still continue on with her special diet of having soft food.
Okay, good luck, Candace. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And, of course, we are talking about pets, and we have one line open. Get to that phone, 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Right now, we're going to go right back to the phones and talk about pet care. First up, we have Perry in Adams Friendship. Hello, Perry.
Hello. Yeah, I've got to thank you for taking my call. I've got a Schnoodle. He's smarter than I am, but I spoiled him with treats. But he's got to eat his food before he gets any treats. But I'm just concerned about the rawhide part of it. And they say the teeth of these dogs is very sensitive, and when we had him into the vet last time, he said, keep doing what you're doing. It's the best teeth I've seen in this type of dog. So are rawhide bad for him, or...
Well, there's a, kind of the rules of rawhide that I have are, one, know that it's very high in calories. And so if your pet has a weight issue, using things like rawhide may be not the best for them. I would be recommending, if they really like to chew on something, taking some of their diet and maybe putting it in a food dispensing toy or into like one of those Kong things and freezing it so that they can chew on that and get rewarded with whatever's coming out of it. We do worry sometimes about dogs choking on rawhide, and so I never leave dogs alone with it. I want to make sure that they are chewing it safely and not just trying to swallow it whole. In my household, I cannot have rawhide because they just chew it to the point where it's slimy and then try to swallow it, and I'm having to reach in their mouth and pull it out because I've got dogs that are choking. So be really careful with that. Some dogs look at rawhide as I do a box of chocolates, okay? You know, I'm going to be really upset if somebody reaches in and starts taking some of my special candy. Dogs can be the same way with rawhide. So if they are chewing on it and you're seeing it getting small enough that you have to be able to reach in their mouth and take it away, and they become aggressive and defensive that I want to keep chewing on this, then that would probably not be the appropriate thing to have if you have to have a challenging relationship with your dog that way. Some of the rawhide that has been really really bleached and treated. It's usually the imported raw hides that are coming from countries where there may not be as much regulation as there are is in the United States, have been noted for causing neurologic problems in dogs, different toxicities. So be careful. Get only U.S.-made rawhide. Many pet stores will just have rawhide in bulk, and you don't know where it came from. So make sure that it says, you know, made in the United States. One thing that bothers me is there's a brand of rawhide out there that says, you know, I think it's American rawhide, but it's made in Brazil or someplace else, even though it says American on the label. So you want to see that little flag that says made in the United States on it. If you're wanting to use some type of chew that's going to be helping your dog with its teeth, follow the recommendations on the website that is the Veterinary Oral Health Council, VOHC.org. They've got a list of dental approved treats and things that are out there, including some of the rawhides that are available if you're using those for your dog. There's some that are treated with enzymes to help keep the mouth clean as well. So if you want to stay with something that's going to keep your pet's mouth clean, follow the ones that they recommend because they've looked at all the testing that's been done and put their seal of approval on products. So that's good luck. I'm glad your dog has nice clean teeth because that's something that's often overlooked.
It certainly is, and it's pretty expensive to get them clean.
Oh,
so
yes.
If you can prevent it. And that was
VOHC, Veterinary Oral Health Council.
.org. .org. Okay, great. Thanks, Sandy. We're going to go back to the phone here. We've got Chuck in Rockland. Hello, Chuck.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had my dog recently to the veterinarian, and she's been diagnosed with dermatitis, moisture dermatitis. And I'm wondering, is there anything I can do for her outside of the antihistamine that was given by the vet?
Yeah, normally dogs that, when we say dermatitis, that just tells me the skin is inflamed, and it doesn't tell me what's causing it. So when we have an animal with skin disease, often we will take microscope slides and have a look to see what the organism is and base our therapy on that. Sometimes we'll have yeast infections, sometimes we'll have bacterial infections, and depending on what we find, we may recommend various medicated shampoos, often antifungal agents, oral antibiotics that would be appropriate. Sometimes we have to base that on culture as well. If it's especially with staph infections, we see a lot of resistant bugs with that. And you have to treat long enough. Usually we're looking at for bacterial infections, a minimum of 2 weeks, and then usually 1 more week after that. So it often takes a couple of weeks to clear up, and then we treat for 1 week post-cure. So usually it's 3 to 4 weeks of being on antibiotics. So it takes a really dedicated owner to continue on using an antibiotic that long. So I'm unable to, without knowing what is actually causing your dog's moist dermatitis, be able to help you. But if it was like your classic, what we call a hot spot, which is an oozy sore that the dog often creates, it's very painful, they're often licking and chewing at it, keeping them away from it with using an e-collar is going to help have that area dry up as well. And they usually will need to be on an antibiotic to get it under control.
Okay, thanks for the call, Chuck. Marilyn in Milwaukee, you're up next. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I'm really happy to have you take my call. Sandy, you're very knowledgeable. I'm very concerned about glyphosate or Roundup that people are using on our lawns and having dogs and cats and other animals be exposed, because I know that I have health issues from this, and I know that I have had cats and dogs actually have cancer and kidney problems who have died. So I'm very concerned.
Yes, and it is one of those things where you have to be careful, because even though it says on the package, once it's dry, your pet should be safe to go out there, a lot of pets like to chew on leaves and chew on grasses, and they may be ingesting it. Sometimes, you know, it's they're out there while it's still wet, and it could be a problem with them absorbing it. We do know that it is a carcinogenic herbicide that is very commonly used, and so being careful if you have pets and avoid its use if possible. And, you know, you can't stop your neighbors from using it, but you can definitely control what's in your yard to be able to keep your pets healthier. The EU is even looking at potentially banning the use of Roundup and related products because of the carcinogenic risk, not only to animals, but people as well. So just really be careful when anything you're applying in your yard with your pets, because their lifestyle is a little bit different than ours. We don't typically go out in our bare feet and walk over the area or eat the grass that's been treated.
No. I don't eat the grass. No. I try to avoid it. So thanks for bringing that up for us, Marilyn. Let's go to Chris in Ottawa. Hello, Chris.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a golden retriever who's 14 who was in for his annual, and they didn't, in May, so recently, didn't find any health issues with him. His activity's great. He's been on the same kind of food. But in the last 3 weeks, he has developed so much gas, and he's very flatulent all of a sudden. Is there something I should be worried about, or should I change his food?
As long, I mean, if his stool is normal and it's just the gas issue that you're dealing with, I'd be, number one, making sure that your pet doesn't have any intestinal parasites. Probably the leading parasite that causes dogs to be extra gassy is one called Giardia. And it is very common to miss it on a stool check because they shed their cyst stage intermittently and we may not pick it up. And so sometimes we just go through a round of a treatment. Typically, it's a drug called fenbendazole. It is even available over the counter. If you go to any of your like farm type stores, can't remember exactly what the brand name is, but if you look for fenbendazole, it comes in little packages based on your pet's weight. That is the three packages. When we're treating for Giardia, we like to use it often for 5 days. So you'd have to buy two sets of these packages to be able to get the five doses because it comes in a three-dose pack. But we use it daily for 5 days. And I'd be recommending doing something like that because it is common. Dogs pick it up from just drinking out of puddles and streams and being around where other dogs have eliminated, like dog parks and things. So that would be the first thing I would do. If your dog's been normal on the diet, I don't know if I'd be really recommending a diet change, especially if there isn't any other GI upset like, you know, gurgly tummy, vomiting, diarrhea. So if you wanted to try something, I would say going with a really highly digestible diet. And this would be a therapeutic diet that you would get from your veterinarian that's a low-fat, low fiber, so there's less ammo for the bacteria in the gut to be able to make the gas that comes out the other end. So that would be a diet you may want to try just to see if it does make your dog feel a little bit better.
Okay, lots of options to choose from there, Chris. Next, we have Brittany in Wauwatosa. Hi, Brittany.
Hi. So I have a nine-month-old St. Bernard puppy. And I was wondering what you would be able to tell me about entropion. Mm-hmm. My vet mentioned that he probably has entropion of one of his lower eyelids, and she said that he would probably need surgery down the road.
Yeah, he's a large breed dog, is going to be continuing to grow for a period of time. And so what entropion is rolling in of the eyelids. So the haired skin on the face is now rubbing on the eyeball. It can be very uncomfortable for the dog. I know our ophthalmologists for growing dogs will often put in a temporary tack where they just put a suture in to kind of hold that, roll that eyelid out so that as the dog grows, they stay comfortable and he may grow into that skin. if he doesn't, then you are looking at having surgery done. And it is an art to be able to take away enough of that eyelid, the skin, to have the lid sit in a normal position and not take too much to have it be rolling out the other way, which is called ectropion, which can create problems with now having that pocket for foreign material to gather and irritate the eye too. So talk to your vet about putting a temporary tack in.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that call, Brittany. We've got a couple of minutes left, but we've got one question here, Sandy. Lola in Green Bay is dog sitting this week for a friend, and she emailed and said that the very sweet 85-pound female ran toward a cow and rammed her head against the cow's head.
Oh, my goodness.
So now one of her ears is swollen like a water balloon, and her owner says that he checked with their vet, and it doesn't seem to be a concern. But Lola's worried. Obviously, she's, you know, sitting. Yep. Might it be infected or need to be drained?
Yeah, it sounds like the dog has what's called an oral hematoma, or a blood pocket in the ear flap. And anything that causes acute trauma to the ear, even if the dog's scratching or shaking their head because they have an ear infection, can break these blood vessels. And it sounds like this may have been from running into a cow. We do recommend having it drained. It is a surgical procedure, because the ear, if you don't fix it, is going to be permanently disformed. It'll end up all crinkled and so on and scarred, and that can interfere with the ability to have the ear get the normal air circulation that it needs, and the dog looks funny. So, but it can probably, if it's just going to be a matter of a few days, can wait till the owner's home.
Okay, yeah. So will it go down by itself at all?
It will, but then the cartilage of the ear flap will be all deformed. It scars down. So it really, surgery is the way to go.
Okay. Interesting that dog went off after a cow.
Well, it might be some, like, it's a herding type behavior. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, we're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She is a clinical instructor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Stay with us because we'll be back right after this look at the news from WPR and NPR. Well, we're talking about pet care today. What questions do you have? I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for the vacationing Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is back with us. She is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Give us a call if you've got a question, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Sandy, you wanted to talk about this interesting gene. It's called multi-drug resistance 1 gene, or MDR1.
One.
What is that?
Well, the reason why I brought it up is my daughter had adopted a dog that was a mixed breed dog that came from Arkansas and wanted to find out what was in the dog's makeup. And anyone that's doing these genetic testing now, there's one that you can get, you know, just buy online. It's called the Wisdom Panel. Will include whether your dog is diagnosed with this particular genetic defect called the MDR1 gene. She had her dog tested and he came back as a carrier. There has to be, you know, if you're a carrier, that means that you've got one gene, not both of you're not carrying two copies of it, just one. And even dogs that are carriers can have some issues with this. And what this gene actually does is it codes for a specific protein that helps make up the blood-brain barrier. And so when you've got a fully functioning gene, this barrier that is made that protects the brain from different drugs that are being used in the body, it can save your life. I mean, most drugs, you know, you deal with them, different things, like some of the antidiarrheal products and some of the sedatives and things, we metabolize them and they get excreted. But if you have this gene, they can get into your brain and cause some pretty serious problems. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really helpful for owners to know if their dog has this particular genetic defect, it is fairly common. And when we start looking at the breeds that are most commonly affected, collies, about 70% of them are affected. And, you know, even things like Old English sheepdogs, about 5%, and, you know, border collies around the same level. So it's, you know, a lot of the herding breeds, when we first discovered this, we used to say, you know, white feet don't treat, meaning that if it's a herding breed, we've got to be really careful. But even dogs like my daughter's dog, who is half pit bull, is a carrier of this. And so you can't just look at the dog and know whether they actually have this genetic defect. If your dog has been diagnosed with this, then it's important to share that information with your veterinarian, because it's going to make a difference as to what drugs we use, or even what dose of drugs we use. And so drugs that, you know, we typically use, like you can get loperamide, which is Imodium, that a lot of people have on their shelf. If their dog has diarrhea, they may just pull that down and use it. You really have to be careful with using that. Many of the sedatives and things that we use, like acepromazine, often prescribed for travel, can be a problem. Some antibiotics like erythromycin, we don't use that commonly because it tends to cause a lot of GI upset, but that can be a problem for some of these dogs. The thing that isn't a problem, though, are heartworm preventatives. I had a client in the other day with a mini Aussie, one of the breeds that we tend to see this genetic problem in. And he's like, I don't want to use this particular heartworm preventative. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, it's toxic for this particular breed of dog. At the level we're using all of the heartworm preventatives, it's very, very safe, even for dogs that have two copies of this MDR1 gene, genetic defect. You have to be careful with using these drugs off-label at much higher doses. So if we were using it for treating mites or something, it would really be a problem for these dogs. So, I think it's just a good idea to know what is, you know, affecting your dog. And if that is an issue, make sure it gets in their medical record, because it's going to change the way we treat them.
So do you suggest people get that, those genes tested?
When people ask me, should I have my dog genetically tested? In the past, I used to say, well, it's kind of, you know, for cocktail party conversation. Guess what my dog is, you know? And but now that they're including things like this for these genetic diseases, I think it really makes it worthwhile for pet owners to spend this $70 or $80 to be able to have that information, not only what your dog is, but do they carry any of these other traits that could be problematic?
Are there more than one company that does this?
You can get this testing done. I know that Washington State University Vet School does some of the genetic testing. There are other genetic testing kits. I'm just not familiar with any of the other ones that are out there. The Wisdom Panel is the one that's been there the longest and seems to be the most reliable,
Wisdom
at least
panel.
From my
okay.
point of view.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Thank you. And before we go back to the phones, Mark in Sun Prairie had called and couldn't stay with us, but he has a family member with a new kitten, and he was wondering, what are good resources, websites or books for a new cat owner, and what's a healthy diet for the new kitty?
Well, the two books that I would be recommending, one would be the ASPCA's Complete Guide to Cats. I think that is one of the best books that's out there, because it covers everything from health issues to behavior problems to, you know, introducing other pets. The whole gamut of things that you need to know when you're bringing in another species into your household. The other person, I've actually worked with her in the past, is Pam Johnson Bennett, and she's written a number of cat books, and the one that I would be recommending is her book that's called Think Like a Cat. And it, again, is looking into more of the behavior issues, but that's one of the common reasons that a lot of people relinquish their cats to humane societies, is they've maybe only provided them with one litter box, so they don't understand, cats' normal behavior with scratching, and they destroy the furniture, and so they get rid of the cat. So it really helps to know what's normal behavior and how to be able to work with them, and Pam's books are great for covering that. when it comes to websites, one of the ones that I send a lot of people to is the called Pet Veterinary Partners. It's the Veterinary Information Network's like kind of public service out there to provide up-to-date current information that you can just put in a, you know, like litter box issues, and it'll come up with a nice client education handout and material that's written by veterinarians. They go through this and update them frequently, and it just covers everything, not just for cats, but dogs as well. And I think that's a great place for trusted information.
And as far as a healthy diet?
I would be recommending just a growth formula
growth
food for this kitties, mm-hmm. And making sure that you're feeding. I would start meal feeding this kitty right away, even though it's a kitten, probably 3 to 4 small meals a day, and then gradually switch over to probably a couple of meals a day, kind of feeding the cat like you do a dog so that they don't become overweight and we have that ability to adjust mealtime and not have a cat that needs to have food down 24/7 and is overeating.
Okay, well, have fun with that new kitty, Mark. Now let's get back to those phones. We've got Kara online from Finland, Minnesota. Hi, Kara.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My dog had an epilus. This was a couple of years ago, and then he had something where he had some bleeding recently, and I brought him in, and the doctor said, well, we'll try this, and if it doesn't clear up, we'll go in and do surgery. And I don't know if it's the same thing as 2 years ago, but it's odontogenic, so it sounds like an epilus again, but now she's saying because of its placement that, you know, we can go in every, like, so often 3 months, maybe 6 months, and cut out more, but that he'll only have about 2.5 to 3 years before we can't do anything. And I was just wondering if there is anything I can do, like maybe, you know, I've heard of, like, for cancer, like CBD oil or something like that, and I was just wondering if there is anything I can do that would either slow the progression. Like, I've tried not to use, like, rawhide chews because you've heard bad things about them. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do.
Yeah. What you're describing, an epilus, covers a whole group of different oral tumors. It's one of the more common oral tumors that we see, especially in the smooshed face dogs like boxers and bulldogs. I had a dog that had one as well. And it's a tumor that it originates from the ligament that holds the tooth in the socket. And so when we go in and just debulk the mass and send it in, obviously we want to know, confirm that that's what it is, that it's one of these benign gum tumors. Once we've got that and we know that there, it's something that we can just watch, sometimes just debulking it and sitting back and waiting to see when it returns or if it returns is fine. Some of these forms of epilus that we see in the dog's mouth can be more invasive, and they're usually called acanthomatous epilus, and that's where having it biopsied, not just removed, but removed and biopsied, is going to help you and your veterinarian with a plan. So if you haven't had this looked at again and rebiopsied, it could be a different type of tumor, or it may be one of these hotter epilus type tumors that needs to be more aggressively treated. And when we say aggressive, depending on if you need to get rid of it. So my own dog, we had to not only remove the tooth, and it was affecting one of her canine teeth, but some of the bone surrounding it, because that's where that ligament attaches and it invades into the bone. And so she had some of her lower jaw removed and did very well. And this might be something that your veterinarian would be comfortable with doing. It may require that they go to a veterinary oral surgeon to be able to have enough of the bone removed and everything closed so that your dog can still have a functional jaw. But yeah, that is more problematic when it's way back there, because you're dealing with a big tooth and a big socket and a lot of bone, and it's right where that structural stuff is with the jaw motion and things. So I think going the more aggressive route would probably be better for your dog than just saying, let's just debulk it every few months.
Okay, good luck, Kara. Next we have Jill in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
What's your question?
I have a cat, Emily, who's just about 18 years old. She has started meowing constantly. She's not sleeping. She's meowing. But she seems really healthy. She's eating. She's going to the bathroom. I just can't figure out. She just doesn't seem sick to anything, and I don't know if it's a behavioral thing. We haven't changed anything in the house that would cause any behavioral issues.
Yeah, the two big things that come to my mind, one is a common condition in elderly cats called hyperthyroidism. They often look initially really good. They're eating well. They're really active. And you think, wow, my 18-year-old cat is, look at this kitty. She's socializing. She's, you know, up and moving around. And it's because they're in this state of having too much thyroid hormone and their metabolism is increased. And one of the signs that we'll see is increased yowling and meowing. And often they're more active. They may eat more, drink more, urinate more. It's a simple blood test to be able to get that diagnosed. And sometimes we can even, by looking at the cat, we'll see a trend in them losing a little bit of weight. We can sometimes feel a thyroid goiter when we palpate their neck. An active goiter can be very small, about the size of a lentil. So depending on your cat, your veterinarian may or may not be able to feel it. So that's why we all often, if we're suspicious of a cat being hyperthyroid, recommend having a blood test done. The other thing that I would be concerned about is, how is your cat's hearing? Sometimes cats that are deaf lose that auto feedback of their voice. And so they tend to be more vocal. And so that could be an issue. And that would be something where, you know, just making a noise while your cat's sleeping and see if you get a startle response to rule out whether they have an issue with deafness or not. And the last thing, it would be, does your cat have an issue with senility? Being at the age she is, almost all cats over 16 years of age are going to have some form of cognitive decline, and they'll often be wandering around and more vocal. And that's a rule out process. You have to rule out all the other medical conditions like hyperthyroidism before we get to that. But there are some treatments that are available to help improve brain function that may help your cat. So I think it's a visit to the veterinarian, get some blood work done, good physical exam, and then take things from there.
Okay, thank you so much for the call, Jill. We'll go to Margaret in Beaver Dam next. Margaret?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have recently adopted two puppies from Texas, and one, and small breeds. We have never had a small breed like this before. One is a Chihuahua, I believe, Minpin mix, but we haven't had a DNA test done on her to know for sure. The problem with her seems to be that she doesn't always want to eat her food right away, and with the other dog there ready to eat it, they have to really keep a close watch on them while they're eating. And she'll go up to the food, sniff it, and walk away and sit there and just watch the other dog eat. And then sometimes she'll come back a little bit later and eat a little bit of it and then go away again. And our vet told us, well, just don't worry about her. If she goes a couple of days without eating, she'll be fine, and she'll eat eventually. I guess I'm a worrywart, so I worry about that. And she has not been losing weight. She's been gaining, and I think she's at her full weight at 8.5 pounds. She seems to be right there for quite a while now.
Yeah, when we have two dogs with different eating habits, it can be a problem for owners. And this happens with cats as well. You know, we've got some that eat to live and others that live to eat. And it sounds like she's one of these ones that eats to live. She's growing, maintaining her weight, but just not, doesn't have a big appetite. Your options would be either stand guard, you know, put the food down and let her, if she doesn't want to eat, try a meal a little bit later. And again, protect her food dish from the other dog. dog. You may want to feed her separately in a crate so that she has her own little restaurant booth that she can have her dinner in. And many dogs, if they don't have that competition with another dog around, may eat. I don't get caught in the trap of adding extra things to help her to eat faster, because that can create a monster where you've got a dog that only will eat when her food is topped with better and better and better things. And now you've got a dog on an unbalanced diet. So I agree with your veterinarian. It sounds like she's just one of these slow eaters. I brought it up earlier in the show using some of these electronic feeders that are available, where if she's microchipped, only she can get in there and the other dog can't, so that if she is one of these grazers, you can put in the right amount of food to maintain her body weight, the number of calories that she needs, and she can go over multiple times a day. The flap will open and she can eat, and then she walks away, it closes up, and the other dog can't get in there. They don't work, though, those electronics. Some of these electronic feeders don't work well for large breed dogs. They work really well for cats and small breed dogs, so I'd look into that and see if that isn't something that would make your life a little bit easier than having to always be there as the maitre d' at the doggy restaurant.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you, Margaret. Next, we have Natalie in Eau Claire with a question. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, yes. I have owned pugs for several years. It's the only breed of dog I've ever owned. And I've never had an issue with keeping their face wrinkles clean. I've always been diligent about wiping them out. And until recently, so I have a pug who is about 4.5 years old, and over the course of the last 6 months, he has had 3 or 4 different infections of the upper wrinkle right above his nose. And I just am wondering if you have any suggestions for doing something different to maintain the cleanliness. I used to use Malaquette wipes, and those worked really well. And then for whatever reason, they stopped working. I've tried diluted dish soap and water. I am currently trying baby wipes that are not scented, no alcohol, no scent. He's currently on his, like I said, third or fourth round of antibiotics. There haven't been any changes in his food or the house or anything, but I'm just curious if you have any other suggestions.
Well, with me living in a household with 3 English bulldogs, I deal with a lot of skinfold issues, not only in the face area, but also with their little curled tails. And some dogs have tighter tails and get the same issue on the other end of their body. You know, finding out what is growing there is going to be helpful. Usually we've got a mixed bag of goodies, because often these dogs, their tongue can even get up in that area. We'll see yeast, we'll see various bacteria. I find that using things like baby wipes or, you know, a washcloth with soap on it just doesn't cut it. You really have to use something that's medicated. And you can buy these wipes, medicated wipes, online. Amazon carries them, various places you can get them through your veterinarian, but I'd be looking for a face wipe that has chlorhexidine in it, and there are many brands that are out there. One of the best websites that I found is there's a bulldog rescue group from Chicago, the Chicago English Bulldog Rescue, CBER. They have a site, like one of their little things you can click on face fold care, and it's excellent, and it talks about how, you know, what to use, how to clean, and I send people there all the time because they do a better job at explaining it than I can, even though I do it every day in my own household. But chlorhexidine wipes may be helpful, and once you get the infection under control, using those on a daily basis may help keep that area that Mother Nature didn't intend to create in dogs. They don't like to have skin-on-skin contact, but because we've selected for these push-face dogs, we have more issues with infections. So using something daily to keep it clean will be helpful.
Okay. And just in the last minute or two before we have to go, Sandy, Ann in Madison emailed, and she wants people to be responsible pet owners and don't bring dogs to hot, crowded, and loud events this summer. She hates seeing dogs accidentally tripped over and stepped on in crowds, and it doesn't take much for the heat on the pavement to become really hot for them.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, even concrete can get to be really unbearable. And so always, like, put your hand on it. If it's hot to your touch, imagine what your dog is like. And remember that the only way that dogs can cool off is through panting and sweating through their feet. And so if you've got a dog, especially ones that are respiratory compromised, like my bulldogs, being out in hot, humid weather is a real stress for them because they can't pant effectively.
Right. Keep them home. Keep them home. We've been talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to Dave Potras for technical direction and Kate Archer-Kent for on-air production. We'll be here tomorrow at 11. Hope you can join us. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Chapter Day's next.